Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
So it's AI with blockchain, with big data.
Buzzword
with
bingo.
Ding, 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 ding.
Welcome to Women Tech Charge with me, Anne-Marie Maffedon. I'm your host. Today I'm joined by co-founder of Entrepreneur First, co-founder of Code First Girls, member of the AI Council. There are so many things I could list off on this. Her actual name is Alice Bentinck.
How do we enable people to become founders? You know, in Silicon Valley, if you're walking down the street and say to someone, have you ever thought about being a founder? They'll be like, well, I've founded three companies, I've invested in two, and, you know, of course. Female founders on the programme, they're often much more willing to work with somebody who they've sort of compromised with. There are so many different versions of entrepreneurship. Whatever kind of version you take, whether it's being kind of a sole founder who just does things by themselves, or whether it's building a team and all the rest of it, I think these skill sets and these mindsets are just totally invaluable right now.
Welcome to the studio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for coming to join us. You are a woman teching charge, I would say.
Trying to, yes.
Yes, personifying. Yeah. I want to go back to the beginning of your story. Let's start at the beginning. It's a very good place to start. Little Alice grew up whereabouts?
I grew up in the New Forest, so on the south coast in this amazing national park. It's the kind of place where ponies and cows roam freely. It
sounds magical.
Really rural. It's the sort of place that until you're about 13 is absolutely divine.
Okay.
And then there's that awful bit between 13 and 17 where you can't drive.
Exactly.
And you literally can't leave.
Other than on horseback?
Oh, I was just obsessed with animals. You know, we were surrounded by animals, and I was completely obsessed with goats,
okay,
obviously. And over time grew a herd of sort of 9 goats trained to do various things. And I think it's the sort of thing that if YouTube had been around, I definitely would have been a YouTube star, because goats are just the most hilariously cute animals. And now goats are kind of everywhere on YouTube and Instagram.
50,000 followers on Instagram and 80,000 likes on Facebook. She made social media pages for the goat with tons of videos showing their daily shenanigans.
Right, so that sounds like a really good beginning of the story. What happens next? How do we go from goats to Entrepreneur First? That's quite a big jump.
So none of my family are in business, and business is definitely not, I don't know, it's just business wasn't even a thing when I was growing up.
Okay.
And tech. My brother was very into technology and was building his own computers when he was young, but really it was kind of quite peripheral to me.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I was in sixth form, I did Young Enterprise.
And Young Enterprise, you start with a tenner, right?
You start with a tenner, yeah. And you then have to kind of come up with a product. I just loved it. And it was just the beginning of kind of understanding that business was a thing and that startups were a thing, and just the rush of having a small team, creating a product and then selling it to people and they would give you money. And I just thought that was just the best thing in the world.
Mind-blowing.
And we created these purses that we made by hand that was incredibly laborious, and the margin was terrible. Mm-hmm. And then what we worked out was, because we were in all girls school, actually what teenage girls would pay for was parties with boys, and so the margins on that were amazing, and so we started throwing parties with boys schools
as part of Young Enterprise.
Yeah, and started making a lot more money. Mm-hmm. I really loved Young Enterprise and did a business studies A level as well.
Okay.
And that was the point where I was like, actually maybe I want to get into this business thing and try this business thing. Mm-hmm. But it did feel really foreign, because my dad was military, my mum was a doctor, and I don't think anyone in our wider family or circle was in business at all. Mm. And then went off to Nottingham and studied management studies.
Oh, okay, cool. So we stayed within the business world.
We did.
But you kind of, your dream. You saw the animals for the last time and then looked forward.
Said goodbye.
Okay, so Nottingham, you're doing this management business degree.
Yeah.
Then what happens?
So when I was at Nottingham, I got involved in a student organisation called Enactus, where you create social enterprises from scratch and basically help the local community or different groups by building these kind of social enterprises. Mm. And again, it was just kind of reaffirmed for me how much impact small businesses could have and kind of the power of creating things from scratch. And that was when I first sort of heard of management consulting as a career path.
Oh, okay.
I think like a careers fair or something like that, and decided that I was going to be a management consultant, and that was going to be the career path for me, as you do when you're 20. And so decided to do whatever it would take to become a management consultant. So did the internships and all the societies and everything that would give me the kind of CV to become a management consultant, and applied to McKinsey, and that became my graduate job.
So you started at McKinsey. You enjoyed it, presumably. Was it everything you hoped?
I mean, the main thing is the work is just so interesting and very full on, and the hours are crazy. Mm. But the real amazing thing about it was just the people. Mm-hmm. Just the so smart, so interesting, so ambitious, so kind of like sparky, that I made some amazing, amazing friends there that I still see regularly, and the kind of network that I built as well.
So how do you decide to transition from McKinsey to entrepreneur first?
I'd always wanted to do my own thing, and ever since doing Young Enterprise, I'd sort of had in the back of my mind, like, how do I get back to that? How do I build my own company?
Yeah.
And it felt like, so I was 25 at this point. Okay. There would be no better time. I had an offer to return to McKinsey, so the risk was reasonably low. Mm. And I was young and had kind of nothing to lose, no mortgage, no dependents. And so I started talking to my friend Matt, who was also at McKinsey with me, and a couple of other McKinsey people as well. And we started coming up with our kind of first startup idea, and did what is a very non-startup-y approach, where we built an Excel model of our startup idea to understand whether it would work or not.
Very consultant-y.
Very consultant-y.
Yeah.
And we did the model, and that took about a week. And then we decided that obviously the model showed it was never going to work.
Right.
So scrapped that idea. And then McKinsey at the time was working on a report for the government around tech cities. So this is back in 2011, when Silicon Roundabout and all the stuff around Old Street was really taking off.
The Mayor of London and I are delighted to announce that government is going to invest £50 million to build Europe's largest indoor civic space on the site of the Old Street Roundabout.
One of the recommendations was there should be a graduate scheme for entrepreneurs.
Okay.
And so Matt and I decided that actually we could do that. Let's see if we can turn that into something.
Yeah.
And so that's when we first decided to take the leap. And so we wanted to kind of say, okay, well, if you're super ambitious, imagine the impact you could have on the world by building your own company.
Right.
And then how do we make that happen? So we've actually moved from graduates to now taking, I think the average age is about 29 years old.
Right.
And so we take people who've been in industry for a while, or who are leaving a PhD or postdoc, or who, you know, the age range is probably 24 to, I think the oldest person we had was 66, but that's an outlier.
We still love you if you're 66. Or 67. You should apply. Come and join.
this idea of how do we enable people to become founders, and you know, in Silicon Valley, if you're walking down the street and say to someone, have you ever thought about being a founder, they'll be like, well, duh, you know, I founded three companies, I've invested in two, and you know, of course. And we just want to get to the place where in the UK you see our most ambitious and talented people have that same approach, where they're involved in startups, they're building the next wave of the economy, the next generation of the economy, and they're building kind of globally important companies from the UK.
And what's your definition of startup? So is it specifically tech startups? Is it broader than that?
We're very focused on tech. Our big thing is building scalable businesses.
Right.
So businesses that can impact people across the world.
Yep.
And so pretty much the easiest and cheapest way to do that is through building technology companies.
Mm-hmm.
So the majority of our portfolio uses some sort of artificial intelligence within what they do.
Do they really use artificial intelligence?
We're actually quite picky about this.
Yes. Little known fact, something like 60% of AI startups across Europe aren't actually using.
Yeah. I mean, one of the one of my least kind of favourite types of pitches is when somebody's like, so it's AI with blockchain, with big data.
Buzzword bingo.
Ding, 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 ding.
So we should talk a little bit about Code First Girls.
Mm.
I know this story, but I'm going to ask it for the listener. What is Code First Girls, first off?
So Code First Girls is a social enterprise that goes into universities and teaches women to code for free.
Although now you do non-university women as well.
Yeah, so we teach women of sort of university age, so sort of 18 to 25 is our sweet spot. How do we get women at the point where they are thinking about their career choices, and how do we make sure that they have the kind of skills and confidence and language to get a career in tech?
And it came out of a problem that you saw running EF.
Yeah, I mean, a problem that I think the entire tech industry struggles with, which, you know, the first two cohorts of EF, we got about 20% of our applications from women.
Okay.
And at the time I was like, this is crazy. This is so bad. Now I realise actually this is just kind of, that's almost what good looks like for the industry, which is unbelievably depressing.
Yeah.
But the original idea was, okay, well, we'll run this sort of marketing campaign called Code First Girls, where we'll get women skilled up technically, and then they'll want to become founders.
Mm.
And it turned out that actually those two things didn't link. Skilling the women up technically didn't automatically make them want to become founders.
Okay.
But what we found was there was just so much demand from young women who wanted to learn to code and wanted to sort of just understand what this world was about, that Code First sort of began to run away with us and became so successful that we span it out of Entrepreneur First as its own separate social enterprise.
Mm.
So now we're teaching sort of a couple of thousand women a year to learn to code across the UK.
Mm.
And the idea is that it's these sort of very, very low barrier to entry. So it's on campus, you're with a group of women who are your own age. It's an amazing community.
Mm.
You very quickly learn how to build a website. And for a lot of the women who go through, that's kind of it. I didn't come from a technical background and basically had to upskill.
Mm.
And one of the guys on our first EF program taught me one summer. He took me through the Stanford Computer Science 101 course.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And
which is widely available, actually.
It's an online
open course, so check it out.
And so I did that for 8 weeks and built my first website and all the rest of it. And I hated it, to be totally honest. I dreaded he taught me for 4 hours every day.
Oh, no.
I hated it, absolutely dreaded it. But I'm so, so glad I did it. And I think it helped me understand technology. It helped me understand the process and the language and the thinking behind how technology works. But also, I'm not going to become a developer. And that's okay.
It's a literacy thing. So what I always end up saying is, you don't learn to write so you can be Shakespeare or be a professional writer.
Yeah.
It's because it's a way of communicating.
Yes.
The same way as you learn to read, but to understand the world around you. So it's more a literacy thing of, you're going to have to use websites. You're going to have to use this technology. Like, it's not going away. It's creeping more and more into our lives and
our
world.
There's a small proportion who try it.
Who hate it. I'm joking.
Small proportion who absolutely love it. And it does change their career paths.
Mm,
and
mm.
they do conversion courses to become developers as a profession.
Yeah.
And I still, there was one woman who was part of our first Code First Girls course. And she came in as a declared technophobe.
Mm.
And she'd always wanted to work in sort of heritage buildings and had absolutely no interest in technology at all. I don't even know why she applied.
Mm-hmm.
And she did Code First Girls and just fell in love with it. She became a professional developer. That's so much of what the good that STEMETS and Code First Girls can do, is just giving women that little taster that then transforms their aspirations.
And you don't know what you don't know. We're not saying sign up and do a degree for 3 years. We're not saying pay however many thousand pounds it is to do this course. It's just come and try it.
Yeah, we get loads of linguists and loads of people that study languages and who are coming at it from
together. It's all the same side of the brain.
It's all the same, isn't it? Yeah.
time for a break. Send me a message using the hashtag, #WomenTakeCharge, and please subscribe and rate wherever you listen to podcasts.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
That's kind of how you started and where you're at now. Mm. What is the actual program? So what does it actually look like? You kind of apply, you're an ambitious technical person. Mm-hmm. You apply for Entrepreneur First. What happens on, when you're accepted, what happens on day one?
Day one, you start with 99 other people and okay. We've got offices across Europe and Asia. Mm-hmm. So let's say you're in London, you start with 99 other people. And at the point where you join us, you don't have an idea, you don't have a team, you don't have anything. And we've just selected you based on your founder potential.
Right.
So we're looking for really smart people, people who can bring a kind of hard skill, people who are committed to the point of kind of shutting off everything else in their life so they can be a founder.
Right.
And people who are contrarian. So a little bit unusual, challenge status quo, a little bit of megalomania, all those kind of things are
okay.
good. And the first 8 weeks are all about finding a co-founder. So
right.
you're basically sorting through these 99 other people to find the right co-founder for you. And so we have this 8-week process, which is a little bit like sort of speed dating on steroids,
right.
where, you know, every couple of days you're trying somebody new to right. see if you can find the right fit. So during that 8 weeks, most people go through about 2.5 other people, mm. 2.5 other potential co-founders.
Right.
About 80% of people get into a team. So even though they're kind of strangers at the beginning, it's such an intense, quite an emotional process as well, that that we end up with these, with the majority of them getting into
and
teams.
Is it mostly pairs?
It is pairs.
Oh, it is pairs.
Because
right.
you're trying to do something quite complicated. You're trying to both build a relationship with a person who mm. you don't know
mm.
alongside deciding an idea to work on.
Mm.
And what we found is that you can do that with two people, but in a team of three, that becomes incredibly complex. So teams of two. And
do you ever have anyone that's a sole founder as part of the program?
Very rarely,
okay.
yeah. Sometimes.
Yeah.
The sole founders normally have come in with something existing, so a piece of technology, or
right.
because it's just really hard to make a lot of progress when you're by yourself. Mm. I think also emotionally it's just, I mean, I'm so glad I have a co-founder, because it's just, being a founder is relentlessly hard. I don't know how people do it by themselves.
So I had a co-founder and don't have a co-founder anymore.
Yeah.
And I think it's really interesting. Emotionally, there is a lot to go through. But I think if you don't have the right match, or human beings are so complex
yeah.
that actually...
It's almost worse if it's not the right person.
Exactly. Mm. So it was something that I found, when we parted ways, it was something that I kind of noticed that a lot of people have been through that thing where actually we've parted ways, it didn't work mm. out.
I think this is the thing. It's so hard to find a co-founder in the wild
mm.
because you are... it's very hard to test people, and so much
yeah.
of what we do at Entrepreneur First is just giving people the opportunity to test co-founders
yeah.
and
yeah.
before you jump in and do the sort of marriage part
mm.
you actually have the chance to do some proper dating.
I get asked quite a lot, or whenever I'm in kind of entrepreneurship events, advice, that kind of thing, people ask quite a lot, where do I find a co-founder, where can I find a technical co-founder, all those kinds of questions. What would you say, is there anything you can say across all the matching and the process you've been through to say, here are maybe three things that you should look for, or you should test in looking for co-founders?
Yeah, great question, and one that we hear often, because it's the process
tough.
Is really, really hard.
Yeah.
So the first thing I would say is create a structure that is easy for you to get out of. So instead of sort of meeting someone for coffee, committing to be a co-founder, incorporating a company, having everyone's names on the cap table, take it slow. So set up a structure where you say, cool, so we're going to do 4 weeks of testing, and this is what we're going to achieve during that period. Mm-hmm. And at the end of each week, we're going to sit down, I'm going to have a really honest conversation about how this is going. Mm-hmm. And then the one thing that we evaluate our teams on that is a really reliable predictor of whether the team will last long term is productivity.
Okay.
So can this team, day on day, week on week, be exceptionally productive? Mm-hmm. And it's that sort of, you know, 2 + 2 = 5 thing where each individual has to feel they are more productive because of their co-founder rather than less productive. Mm-hmm. Actually, this is something I do see with our female founders on the program, where they're often much more willing to work with somebody who they've sort of compromised with, okay. where they're basically carrying them to some extent right. or chivying them to get stuff done.
Yeah.
And I would encourage everyone to be very, very discerning about their co-founder, because if it's week two and you're having doubts, trust me, by, you know, year two, it's not exactly. Yeah. You really need to have somebody who is always making you feel more productive.
The other question I want to ask you, which relates a little bit to Code First Girls, is finding a senior team or finding a CEO. One thing that I've always noticed or appreciated or admired from afar is you set up Code First Girls kind of alongside Entrepreneur First to kind of solve a problem on that, and it was kind of like running the two companies at the same time, and so you had to go out to find a CEO for that kind of sub company / side company / side social enterprise. What were you looking for in that position, and how were you able to find a CEO?
The key thing with those sort of really critical senior hires is you just have to trust the person. And I think the hard thing as a founder is you do have to step back pretty fully. You have to trust them enough that when they make decisions that you disagree with or take different actions, you trust that they're making the right call, particularly when you're building a startup yourself. As you all know, like, you and the startup become so blurred that it's kind of hard to, you know, detangle the two.
So you've gone global. What have been the hardest bits of this journey? It's been 9 years, 8 years?
8 years, yeah.
What have been the hardest bits of this last 8 years?
I mean, all of it, to be totally honest.
It's been hard.
Hard. And I think this is the thing about being a founder, that I can't imagine anything I would have done over the last 8 years that would be as hard, as emotionally challenging, as sort of mentally challenging as building a company.
Okay.
And I also can't imagine anything that would be as rewarding. And I think this is the incredible thing about being a founder, that you're constantly doing things that you just don't know how to do at all. And just at the point where the company's 10 people, you're like, right, I've got it. I know how to manage this. This is working. When we first started, the thing that was really hard was I think we had a lot of existential dread that actually this was just a terrible idea. Mm-hmm. And most people that we talked to who knew anything about startups was like, this is a bad idea. You can't take people who don't know each other. You can't take people who don't have ideas. This is not how it works. Do not do this. Mm. And the only reason we kept going was because we found customers who really wanted to do it.
Mm.
But it was probably 2 years where we had no way to make money. We were, you know, basically, you know, making ends meet very, it was really, really tough. I suppose now it's just a different kind of fear, where it's sort of, we've got 120 people across 6 countries, and it's just a lot of people who are dependent on you in some way. And we work with 800 entrepreneurs a year, and, you know, it's a lot to manage, but I really love, like, I want Entrepreneur First to exist, and I want it to be successful, and I'm very, very happy to dedicate a large part of my life to that. I also think if you're the kind of person that defines yourself by work, which I do, and I think whatever I did, I'd be working crazy hours and throwing myself into it, that how lucky I am to be able to do that for my own company, for something I really care about.
Yeah, running a business, you never really know where the next customer is coming from. Like, it's not a set thing of the salary will be there. So when you're the person that's in charge of everyone's salaries, when you're the person that ultimately in charge of the partnerships and everything else coming in,
so many companies are looking for people with entrepreneurial skill sets and entrepreneurial mindsets that, you know, I think probably 10 years ago, if you had a company and it failed, maybe it would be harder to get a job afterwards. Whereas now we see that our founders who don't make it, they get snapped up so quickly. So I think it has shifted and people are beginning to understand that just the process of going through trying to build a company is just such a valuable lesson.
And accepting failure to be able to survive.
And I think this is the thing, you know, we at Entrepreneur First built a very particular kind of company, which is high growth, normally venture capital backed. But there are so many different versions of entrepreneurship. And I think whatever kind of version you take, whether it's being kind of a sole founder who just does things by themselves, or whether it's building a team and all the rest of it, I think these skill sets and these mindsets are just totally invaluable right now. We don't know what's going to happen to work, and I think it is going to change hugely. But this skill set will prepare you better than any other.
I want to end on what's next. So EF is around the world. You're taking over. Yeah, you do live on a plane between here and Singapore. Before we can inhabit Mars and we have Entrepreneur First Mars, where next? What next? What are the plans that you can share with us, of course?
Yeah, sure. So we are, we're in Paris, London, Berlin in Europe, and we're in Bangalore, and Singapore and Hong Kong in Asia. We have just announced we're opening Toronto.
Oh, nice. 2020,
which is exciting. And I think also when we look at what's going on in the world at the moment, Asia is just so exciting.
When will you go to Nigeria?
Probably in the next couple of years, I would imagine.
Cool.
It feels like at the moment the kind of tech Asian growth curve is just incredible.
I see. Okay.
And we want to capture that. It feels like the sort of Africa and South America growth curve is sort of the next wave. But our whole big thing is wherever the world's most talented and most ambitious individuals are, that's where we want to be.
Plus the ecosystem.
Well, that's the thing. It's waiting. You just have to wait a little bit for the ecosystem to exist.
To catch up.
The world is missing out on so many of its best founders just because of where they were born and just because of where they're located. And Entrepreneur First, in many ways, is like a ecosystem in a box. Like, you find your co-founder, you find your idea, we give you funding, we get you funded. We can help build all these ecosystems around the world and really give access to entrepreneurship to thousands of people who haven't had it previously. Our mission is to transform the lives of the most impactful people, and we want to keep doing that for as long as possible.
Thank you very much. Thanks for all you do.
Oh,
thank you very much.
Right back at you.
Oh, thanks. But thank you very much as well for coming on the podcast.
A real pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And I hope lots of people listening take charge, up the call
now's
to action, and go and learn to code, even if you are going to hate the 4 hours that you spend doing it every day.
Do maybe. It. Still worth it.
Even if you hate it, although pick somewhere that you're not going to hate. That'd be my suggestion. So yeah. Thank you very much, Alice.
Thank you.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.